Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Creekside Room, today's speaker is Jim Boyer. He'll be talking about divine character and parenting. So let's listen in on Jim Boyer.
And we've been looking at family issues. The first week I was here, we were looking at close relationships, intimate relationships, and spirituality. And the second week, we're focusing more on parent and children relationships, specifically in spiritual themes around that particular relationship. And there's, of course, many, many different kinds of angles that we can look at, and there's certainly some overlap, so we look at some of the similar themes as we go through this. But today we want to focus on the theme of how parenting and how parenting tasks reflect God's character or divine being in action. Is another way to talk about that. And that perhaps is a new kind of juxtaposition in our thinking. It's certainly not a new thought generally within the church or whatnot that we as parents or care givers to the next generation are somehow invited to reflect God to our children, and understanding we're imperfect vessels for that task, but as best we can, as we're called to do that in our own life and in society generally. But to look at that specifically with parenting, I think we get a chance to see some of the parallels and some of the flesh out some of the details of both parenting tasks and also the typical kinds of skills and attitudes that we see in a lot of parenting education courses and things like that. So that was the way this session was put together, to look at some of the aspects of God's character, words, and we'll develop a list together that might describe his being in action towards us, his children. And from that, we'll look and discuss at the two other aspects of that, that is parenting tasks, that is what are some of our fundamental tasks as we care for our children, plus the particular attitudes and skills that go along with that. I worked out an outline around that way back in 87, so I'd like to, as I go through that, things are added to it all the time, hello. And so I'm very interested in your input and your ideas around this, because it's probably endless, really, these kinds of lists, but I hope it'll be interesting. I have a couple of things to share out of the books that I bring, the pile of books. Don't just carry them around for exercise. But we'll share those as we go along and try to give you the authors and the titles as we proceed. I think there's a good way to start is to get ourselves thinking about what we would call the divine being and action or character, and there's just a lot of words that might come to mind. Let me prime your own thinking by mentioning some of those. Of course, probably the one that jumped out in my mind first was God is love. So the compassionate or love side of God would certainly be one aspect we'd want to note right away. So let's say here's our list of divine being in action. So love, and scriptures come to mind in all of these. God is love, 1 John 4:8 is the scripture that this comes from. What other aspects or parts of God's character or words come to mind as you think of his orientation towards us? Particularly, let yourself think in terms of God as our heavenly parent, or our Father who art in heaven. He comes to us in love, and other ideas come to mind. Of course, there's so much in that.
Nurturer.
I'm sorry?
Nurturer.
Nurturer, yeah, okay. That's one's a cluster, let's put those together.
Yeah.
Justice. Compassion and reconciling. You have so many words that cluster around forgiveness.
God of love.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Word guidance.
It's like shepherd.
Yeah, shepherd. Yeah. Shepherd and guidance. Good. Okay. Yeah.
Counselor.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the same kind of thing.
If we cluster shepherding and guidance together, yeah, that sense of inner direction, that still small voice that comes to us, would fit there. Yeah. And of course, picking up the different, we just do a word study really of around God and the Holy Spirit as comforter, counselor. Life, good things. Yeah. Yeah, these are sort of.
Just
keep trying. With companion, when you're thinking of that, what a sense of God being available. It's kind of always there. You know, the thing we say, I feel apart from God now. Well, who moved? You know, God didn't move. Something's happened. That fit into that too. There, you know, with that, we might look at Psalms 139. You're all around me on every side. Protect me with your power. So it's a protector. You're around all the time. Companion available. Let's see if you're well protected up here. So, right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. It's just, you know, these are the ways that we understand, try to articulate the mystery of God's relating to us and in a loving, parental sort of way. Has the aspects that we think naturally of parenting, love, justice, forgiving, reconciling, finding a way to keep the relationship connected. Justice having to do with issues of fairness. So I mean, we think about that with good parenting, don't we? It's not just that anything goes, it could be overindulgent, or do it my way or the highway kind of thing. That would be like too rigid, perhaps. So, and somebody mentioned that justice and guidance with flexibility. So, in 1 Corinthians, where it talks about God bringing justice and judgment to us in a way that burns away the stubble and the hay and all that sort of stuff, which is a pretty powerful image. But has that sense of the gracious judgment, which I like to put those two together with the Old Testament and the New Testament, because I think that's one way to bring in that flexibility. The judgment is one, except the overall context is a gracious one. So I would suggest we put that as in front of here. Gracious judgment. Yeah, gracious justice. Sound good on the tape too. Because I'm real busy. Okay. Good. Anything else? Any other piece that fits in here? Of course. Well, that's plenty. That's plenty to go with. So, again, we're looking at divine action and parental tasks. At least it's not as bad as chalk speaking. This is that could talk worse. Parental tasks. And then, skills and attitudes. Okay, that's the five ones that I had worked with in putting this sort of thing together included the love. I used the word consistency, which picks up, I think, that availability sense. Jesus Christ, the same yesterday, today, and yes, forever. That idea of God's consistency, I think, comes through too in Scripture. Just that the sameness, the consistency that we appreciate from our own parents, however that might have come across, and just kind of always being there, always loving us regardless, that sort of thing. Availability. Affirmation and encouragement was another, would be another one that I think picks up on some of these. The nurture, we say love, but then, you know, how is that operationalized, or how is that functional? And perhaps affirmation, encouragement. I'm putting you in charge. Genesis 1:28 idea, which was probably, you know, as Adam and Eve heard that, I would imagine they were both kind of, oh, really? You know, both amazed and surprised. Thank you. Okay, great. Thanks a lot. Thank you. Okay. And then also guidance, which is one of the other ones we pick up there. Counselor, guidance, shepherding, that idea. A scripture there, Psalm 119, your word is a lamp to guide me and a light for my path. So let's cluster those, and let's just go down, and I'll just, I will put on the board the other tasks, but let's just listen through those, starting with love. The parental task I would suggest is the whole area of establishing and building self-esteem. Very a common sort of thing we talk a lot about in parenting. And we understand that the child, as she develops, really does uncritically absorb the way she's related to from early on. That is, most psychological theories will hold that it is that original external environment, or what we might call the emotional uterus, the emotional surrounding holding environment, family environment, that is, call it, introjected or taken in quite uncritically. That is, we don't have 6-month-old, 12-month-old, 18-month-old saying, gee, my mom or my dad isn't, they're not really, you know, they're kind of ambivalent toward me. I need to sort that out. I need to take the good and reject the bad. There's no, you know, capacity that we can really either theorize or see in early development. And I think that's one of the awesome aspects of parental responsibility, and one of the most difficult ones. We talked last time we got together about some of the parenting legacy, some of the soul unfriendly parenting legacy of past history, which could include, you know, the child is so young, this won't affect them, but it's really at that youngest age that there's more susceptibility and more vulnerability to be careful of. Another thing I think that's important to note is families with young children, or single parents with young children, that is the most stressful time of life, often. Financially, emotionally, often family units are establishing themselves, etc. And so you put some of those, you know, developmental things together, and we all, as we know, need God help to do an adequate job. But this becomes even more important, and I think we appreciate the challenge there. So with the self-esteem task, we're instilling a sense of worth in a child, affirming the child's uniqueness. And that has to do with seeing the child not as certainly an extension of ourselves, or someone we can clone spiritually, intellectually, whatever else, values-wise, but someone who's that unique gift. Someone was saying, I think you were saying yesterday, about the just how each child is unique just from the get-go, and you just work with that. All children are keepers, and you just go with what's there, and try to support that and to help that unfolding. And I would say generally, with the families I work in, the parents I work with, I think they generally do a pretty good job with this area. Certainly the intention is there. I mean, there isn't a problem of wrong intention in this area, in our society, say. But I think, as I mentioned this, I think we're looking at the first couple of generations, which are really looking at, you know, how do we do this adequately? And what are perhaps some of the bad habits of past generations or whatever else? How do we weed out and in our own, you know, we're doing it, our chance to do it, to reflect a loving character in our parenting. You know, how do we do that in an adequate way and watch some of the negatives? Yeah. So here, I think where the skills come in, and skills and attitudes there would include, you know, basic nurture, What I mean by that is, you know, that the basic needs are taken care of course. Here's, of course, where Jesus says, don't worry. God takes care of the lilies and the birds and whatnot. That's sort of an idea. Of course, we know who feeds our children. We do that. But, a point of this, I often with middle-aged clients or older clients, I'll often ask how they evaluate the nurturing they received in their families. And they'll often use the phrase, I'm struck just how often this comes up, they'll often use the phrase, I was well cared for. And when we explore that phrase, it usually means I was well clothed, well fed, had opportunities of different sorts, which is important, very important, because the child's spirit will pick that up as a affirming, nurturing, valuing aspect towards them. But it goes beyond that, of course, and those include the listening and reflecting skills. And here's where, the whole business of giving our children enough attention fits into what we understand as general emotional health. And that has a lot to do with whatever the child's experiencing. That doesn't mean everything they're experiencing, but it is important that their environment recognizes their experience. So, for instance, if they're hungry, that somebody recognizes that. If they're sad, if they're happy. Because as you do that actively, and virtually all of the parenting classes out there will talk about active listening and all that sort of stuff. And that's about noticing the child's experience and having an active part in that. And not just waiting for them to come to you. And generally, the younger, the more active the parenting is in this area, where you're noticing their emotional experience. The message, the unspoken message that come across there is, I notice you, you're important. I take time to not just notice and register in my own mind, but articulate or somehow respond and notice. What we understand, the theory I use in terms of I call it emotional metabolism, is that emotions will tend to, they don't disappear, that is our experience, we have our experience, and either we are noticing it, and that's the beginning part of metabolizing our emotions, or the environment around us is helping us to identify and to just recognize the feeling. And this is an important skill because the child needs a lot of help in identifying and learning to notice his or her own process emotionally. And this is what we're talking about here, is validating the process. We don't do it with everything, but it's when the child is in a funky mood or is particularly happy, we help them punctuate and begin to help them put words to their experience. And that's a very important gift to give. We communicate the child is a valuable person, of course, welcome their reality into the world, express the empathy, the accurate empathy, include the child in family events or in certain decisions. Do you want to go to Holden this summer? your vote's important. You include them. That's all part of it. Other skills come to mind in this particular area. Love, building self-esteem. There's so many, but any other ones? Of course, the touching that we talked about yesterday also, this is part of the nurture, the basic nurture, not just food, clothing, but the touching and nonverbal communication is so important there.
Well, I guess I'm just wondering, I don't know if this is off the track or not, but as I'm thinking, if you've been deficient, or what we like to call, what's the word? It's
the buzzword.
Yeah, you've got an area.
Yeah.
Is it so ingrained in them that when you talk about it when they're older, does that make any impact, or is it just so much a part of them that, it's subconscious? How do you counteract?
Uh-huh. If you see something, them being negative on themselves, for instance, you mean?
Or if there's certain, I don't know. Because I wonder about that as far as like kids, like Paul said, he has a thorn in the side, that we all have some kind of some kind of thing that gets us, and we need to overcome that, and yet coupled with family stuff. Does that make sense?
Okay, that's, yeah, it does. I like to, in all of this, and it's important, gives us a good chance to say, you know, we're just shooting for like an adequate level of this stuff. It's, you know, or maybe low optimal. Just trying to avoid inadequate, you know. But those three levels, I think, are really, really important to remember. See, I'm in.
Yeah, I have two more.
Okay, great, great. But, you know, inadequate, oh, this is great, look at this. You know, inadequate is a certain area, and I think it's fairly, you know, fairly well defined. This is all the dysfunctional stuff, you know, and abusive stuff, you know, all that. Adequate. I think it's a pretty large area, you know, of behavioral options. I think a certain adequacy, you know, an optimal, you know, is probably a fairly narrow thing too. But I mean, most of us function somewhere here, you know, middle adequate, and we get, you know, we can chart ourselves out on these things. But I think that's, you know, that's certainly the place to shoot for. And of course, God is at the optimal level with all of this. But when a child is missing a piece, they will, as we do as adults, you know, we'll be working on this. And actually, we all will work on this. I mean, it's important to understand that these are areas that have that are tied to the common growth areas of life. You know, and that at different times, for instance, you're mentioning having teenagers in families. Teenagers normally go through, I hate myself, no, I wasn't asked to be born. Now, this is a normal kind of thing that emerges. It becomes a, you know, an issue or a growth issue when a consistent kind of self-doubt or a level of inhibition is there that doesn't support moving through the stages of development, you know, more naturally. And then, you know, then different kinds of intervention may be called for. And that raises the whole question of when is a, what we call a corrective experience or therapeutic experience, you know, called for. But I think a lot can be done in this area. Parents certainly have the first shot, we might say, but then also how the peer group that a child grows into and grows with, and then also the availability of nurturing and affirming adults beyond the parents are so critical in some of this. So, but in our society generally, I mean, there's a lot of children who also grow up at an inadequate level of this experience. And I think, you know, I think we're still in the middle or the beginning of a revolution around this stuff, where we really are, I think, finally taking seriously what is adequate care for our children, to establish and provide that solid base from which then the adult competencies will come out. So
it seems like in the area of parenting and permissiveness and all that stuff, you kind of go from a pendulum, don't you?
Often, yeah.
Or you're supposed to hold a parent.
Yeah, and to say, you know, there's a revolution going on, you know, I don't know if there was a Dr. Spock in, 100 years ago or whatnot, but I think there's also, though, a kind of evolutionary march going on in terms of finding that better balance, you know, so that the extremes of, you know, regimen and education by controlling the child, you know, we listen to that. I think that's a big part of the spirituality of any part of life, where you maintain a reflectivity about that. And in all of this, there's issues of balance and creative balance, which comes, I think, in all stages of child growing, but particularly with adolescence. You know, how do you have enough structure, but not too much, because then you're going to get that pushback. So, but over, you know, historically, I think there's excesses, and then a generation responds to those excesses, and then they discover their own excesses. Okay, yeah, well, love is the basic thing. I mean, so let me read something from Walter Wegren's new book, Little Lamb Who Made Thee. The subtitle is a book about children and parents. And this is a good the story of his own discovery of what it means to be a parent, and reflect that basic principle we talked about yesterday, which is the parent or God being for us, and just wrestling with that whole business, which we probably do throughout our whole lives, really. Let's see. Oh, this was the other one. Let me see if I can find that here real quick. Oh, yeah. Okay, bear with me here. This is a collection of, I'm pretty sure he's, he has, oh, yeah, here we go. It's called the Altar of Motherhood. These are things that you might have seen or remember as I read them through, but this is it. Deliberate, devout, and beautiful, the woman walks to the altar and places there her precious gift and watches while it is consumed. How long has this been going on? For eons. How many people have done it? Myriads. But mostly women. Then why haven't we been astounded by such holiness? Well, I think we are by nature blind to sacrifice. Even the receivers of this outrageous love don't truly know its depth if they have never felt the wound of it. Have felt the sweet blessing only. Perhaps we have to suffer sacrifice in order to understand it. Perhaps that's why I didn't know my mother well. I mean, I didn't know the quality of her love until I myself experienced her circumstance and did myself make a mother's choices. Children, honor that woman who, for your sake, placed on the altar of motherhood some core part of her precious self. Honor and do not neglect her. In 1985, Thane and I switched household duties. Scary thought. She went to work full-time, and because mine was the more mobile work, I brought it home. Writing had become my primary profession. Now housekeeping became my primary obsession. From that year forth, I took over the cooking, the shopping, the kitchen, the bed, and the bedroom, yay, and the children. Through the winter and spring of 1985, things went swimmingly. By 8 in the morning, I was alone in the house, busy in the kitchen to be sure, but at the same time, thinking through the day's writing ahead of me. By 9, dinner was in a crock, and I was at the typewriter. For 6 solid hours thereafter, the writer wrote. At 3 in the afternoon, the children came home, so writing was done. The writer turned into a father, and the father emerged from his study, ready to usher his children everywhere. I cheered their games, I refereed their arguments, I disciplined and pitied, and talked and cooked and set the table in time for dinner to begin at 6, when Thane got home. Thus the noonday writer and the afternoon father thrived, both of them, so long as they stayed separate. But then came June, and my dear children came home to stay. Now, I had committed myself to completing a book-length manuscript that summer, but I trusted my ability to organize, and I intended to accomplish the same amount of work now as I had when school was in session. I established a schedule to occupy the kids with an equal mix of chores and recreation while I wrote. Of course, I would write. There never was a question about such a thing. I was a writer. That was my core self, my purpose for being. But the telephone was suddenly seized with 1,000 fits of ringing a day, and the children ate meals whenever the mood took them, and friends came over shouting, fighting, laughing, interrupting the sweet symmetry of my schedule, chores, and recreation. Okay, so I had to stop writing, come out of my study, put limits on the use of the phone, dismiss kids who were not my own, remind my own over and over to clean the kitchen after their meals, and stab my finger for emphasis at the schedule on the refrigerator. Do, 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 you fools. Back to writing again. Phew. Ah, but even when I didn't rush out of the study, every time a kid raised his voice, I had to stop to listen, to figure out what was going on. Or any time the kids lowered their voices, I had to stop to listen even harder. Silence is dangerous, and if you can't hear it, you have to go see it. So up and out I went after all. And you cannot schedule arguments, and you can't plan tragedies. So I stopped writing. I burst out of my room, I yelled, I arbitrated, I held my poor daughter till she stopped crying. Ache, I stopped, and I stopped. I broke kids here, brought kids here, I drove them there, I answered their questions, I filled out their forms, I took them swimming, and I blew up. Let me alone. Just let me alone. I've got to write. Shh, Daddy's going crazy. Okay, so I stopped writing altogether. That is, I decided it was time for a whole... I took a week's break from writing, calmed my spirit, jettisoned all that I had so miserably written during the first days of summer, quietly instructed the children in the niceties of my job. It feeds you, sucker. And sat down to start all over again. Refreshed, because of course I would start over again. I would surely write. It's who I am, you see. Can anyone explain to me why, if you have told your children never to interrupt you, do they interrupt you with little whispers as if whispering were better, as if whispering proves them obedient after all? I hate whispering. It drives writer daddies mad. Okay, so then why don't children interrupt you when they're about to take off for parts of the city you've never yourself had the timidity or stupidity to enter? And why must the writer daddy come out of his study to find the house as dead as marble, wondering where his children have gone and whether his previous rage is the cause of their present danger? Dumb, 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 daddy. 3 times that summer I stopped, cooled, smiled, gathered my forces, and started all over again. 3 times my children slew the book in me. 3 times. But these kids were not bad kids. No, they were just plain kids who needed a parent. It's the order of things. They needed a presence, a mother. And I am so slow to learn, and finally only experience itself teaches me. By bending me to the right will, the holy way. Finally, I bowed my head before my children's natural need. Finally, I confessed in my soul, this is right. These children of mine must take precedence because they are children and they are mine and they come first. Yea, though it consume me. Then I discovered my mother's mothering and the astonishing quality of her love. Then when I sacrificed the writer self and consciously renounced my book and offered my children completely a parent. I had to do the former to allow the latter. These were the same act, after all. I had to let the core of me die, for a while at least, that they might properly live. Ah, mother, every summer since then I have thought of you and of all your sisters through the ages. I see you, darling, distinctly as in a vision. I see deep and I see this, that once there lay in a precinct of many mother souls, some precious personal thing, some talent, some private dream, the characteristic by which they defend themselves and their purpose of being. To write, maybe, to run a marathon, or to run a company? Yes, yes. But then the baby came home, and then you and others like you made a terrible, terribly lovely choice. You reached into your soul and withdrew that precious thing and lifted it up before your breast and began to walk. Deliberate and utterly beautiful, you strode to an altar of love for this child and placed there the talent, the dream, some core part of your particular self. And in order to mother another, you released it. There came for you a moment of conscious, sacred sacrifice. In that moment, the self of yourself became a smoke, and the smoke went up to heaven as perpetual prayer for the sake of your children. And when it was voluntary, it was no less than divine. Never, never let anyone force such a gift from any woman. For then it is not sacrifice at all, it is oppression. But never either, dear children, take such an extraordinary love for granted. It is holy, for this, in the face of such women, is the mind of Christ, who emptied himself for us, and then again for us. Ah, mother, I am slow to know, but now I know. And out of the knowledge wherewith my own children have burdened me, I thank you. From an overflowing heart, I thank you, mother, for your motherhood. Well spoken. Well spoken. It gets to the core of that love place, love sacrifice. As I reread this time, I was thinking, of course, of the difficult choice of our present society, so much the dual career mother or father, dual career family, and the tremendous challenge to get hit that adequate level. Which is so tough, because of course the adequate level of financial support and all that is there too. But this is right.
Trying to get to the point of what some people call quality time.
Yes, right.
When she comes home from work, she's so busy.
Yeah.
She can hardly spare the time to get quality time to the kid.
Yeah, and then we go back to divine character. You know, we say, well, you know, I pick up the God phone, and you know, is it ever busy? Well, you know, no. It's a real honest struggle, though. We just appreciate that. That's a very honest struggle. Okay, consistency would be another one. With structure and discipline as the parenting task, gets back to that gracious judgment idea, too, I think, see? Structure and discipline is part of it. The task is passing on the basics of right and wrong, relating, etc. Now, some of you, I'm sure, know about Lawrence Kohlberg, his work in terms of the moral development of children, and he's done a good job of looking at different stages we go through, recognizing that other people have the same rights as we do, and learning to share, and you know, all that good stuff. And this is certainly a big part of this particular task. And I would put it under consistency, because I think we all have, you know, a basic sense, whether it's defined by the Ten Commandments or just that sense of God's law being written in our hearts, that we, you know, will throw the yellow flag, so to speak, when the big transgressions are there. But it's that consistency that comes through in terms of skills and attitudes as having some objective rules that the parent also follows, which is sometimes the catch. So it's developing our own moral consistency so that we're modeling and presenting a congruent picture to the child. And of course, we have a God who that's what most theologians will say was the essence of Jesus' power, was his integrity and the you know, the consistency with which he did what he said he did. So his words and his actions reflected a power in his ministry. So objective rules are important, from curfews to cleaning to all that sort of stuff. We hear a lot from Dreykean people who are behind the logical and natural consequences of things. But has everybody heard those things, the natural logical and consequence? Just briefly, that is where you let the child and present the child, sometimes younger children, the choices in a certain situation, and then let them experience what the natural consequences of those choices are, within reason, of course. They don't have unlimited choices. But an example of that would be, I don't want breakfast this morning, Mommy. I'm not hungry. Besides, I don't like mush, and, you know, forget it. You know. So, okay, you have to understand, you may be hungry before lunch starts, and you won't be able to eat anything. Well, that's okay. That's okay. You know, don't let them, they don't eat. And we've got a lot of, eating is a good example, I think, because we usually have a lot of internal sense of you know, nurture. Again, I've got to get something in my child's stomach. But that would be an example of letting them experience the logical consequence of their choice. There's many examples there, and the logical consequence, natural consequences, has to do with when a parent doesn't intervene. A logical consequence would be where you need to set up a consequence. Like if you're going to be yelling while the rest of the family is trying to watch a program or whatever else, then you're choosing timeout by doing that. It's sort of a social consequence that the parents bring to the situation. Realistic view of the world is something to come to show at on this particular one, I think. What that basically means is that you know, you don't you know, always talk about the difficult aspects of life, but you also try to present as realistic picture as possible to your children. That those who don't work don't eat so well. You know, some of the basic realities. People take turns, and you reflect that as parents. When we go back to the divine character, I think we see that God certainly doesn't rescue us, and also, you know, lets the logical consequences affect themselves in our lives. Remember a pastor of mine once preaching about gravity and talking about, well, if you walk off a roof, God will not will not save you. And we watch our children really discover these things and help them put two and two together. But, you know, the typical example of touching a hot stove, children are so vulnerable, they cannot know until they experience, and they almost want to experience in order to learn. So, you know, we talk about the tough lessons, and we hope our children survive the tough lessons of life. And I think if we go all the way back to the beginning, the Garden of Eden, I think we would see that principle there, too. That, I mean, what could be like a more, far-reaching consequence than the fall, but it's a mystery, a theological mystery, certainly, you know, how that was allowed, etc., but it just seems to be part of the picture. Another piece would be the clear limit setting, and that's where, you know, the just the basic rules that you have, and this is just tricky, you know, it it's really a judgment call, a subjective call. And that changes too. As soon as you have something, you know, set down, then the child is ready for more responsibility or whatever else. So this parenting dynamic is a very dynamic one. But, and this is why oldest children get the extra points for being the firstborn and breaking their parents in, because we kind of get a feel for that sort of stuff. Any oldest children here? Yeah, okay, yeah, you sort of get extra points. I don't know when you cash in. Yeah, that's...
I think they'll show the story of Little Women, too.
Oh, is it? I remember the story vaguely, yeah, uh-huh, with the three daughters, yeah, right.
That's, first one had to kind of break the ice, and the rest of them just kind of floated along.
Yeah, yeah, those are real important folks.
However, the younger also will tell you, he or she gets to do it, why can't I?
Yes, it's the other thing, we can talk about these skills and things, right, but you always have a, you get evaluation every day.
Sure.
Yeah, pretty good. And there really isn't any way to win. That's why a healthy support network, either with a spouse or friends, is crucial with this.
Because it doesn't seem like there's a lot of justice in that to the younger one. The older one gets to stay out an hour later, or gets to drive the car more than the younger one, or something else when they get to be older.
And actually, parents often do change, yeah, that sort of thing. Or they mellow, you know, is a typical thing. And there is an unfairness there. That's why, as somebody said, justice, you know, is one of the characteristics. But we try to approximate that, you know. And usually, I think, as we said last time, it's when our children have their own children that really some of this will come into focus. And so we may hear, negative feelings for a long time about some of that. Which is a good point. I mean, you know, life is tough enough, and. I think birth order is one of those wonderful excuses to, you know, to really claim injustice in your life and really feel a thing. But when we go back to validating feeling, we could say, what do we do with that? You know, well, we can feel guilty or bad, and it's a good probably to review if we're doing favoritism or not. But we'd also validate, yes, that's tough. It is tough to be. The youngest in the family, the middle, you know. So, and that's just not patronizing or just saying nice words. It really does validate that each child's position really has a unique struggle to it. The first is breaking in the parents. Second born is one role the family's already chosen, so their choices are limited. You know, already the third born, there's two slots. You know, how does he or she fit in? So we. Which can be, yeah, good and bad, right, depending on the family's legacy. And so we appreciate without being persuaded what that is. Okay, so let's see. A third one would be the availability we're talking about. You're all around me on every side. You protect me with your power. Here, the parenting task would be security and trust. Basic thing, and there's so many things that go into this in which we provide our children with a sense of security and trust, and communicate to them that God and others can be trusted, help is available. Here, of course, is where issues of abuse are so important, because a child naturally trusts us and will look to the adults for their resourcing. But then that trust gets betrayed, and this is the big way that gets talked about. Then you injure that basic sense of life being trustworthy, or by extension being trustworthy. And so I think this is one of the most sacred, assignments, let's say, in our parenting, is communicating that security. Certainly we fly off the handle. Certainly we overreact. Certainly we dip into inadequate things, probably here as much as any, I think, in parenting. But how do we, over the balance, provide that? And here I think skills and attitudes would include you're not alone, that sort of a thing. The resources are here. Reaching out is helpful. It's okay to reach out, to ask for help. This may be a particular challenge for males who kind of are allergic to asking for help early on. And I don't know, when does that begin with males? I don't know, probably adolescence, I imagine. Balance between support and challenge. Important here. Letting go is as important as protecting, too. And there's that tricky balance. But if we go back with, you know, the sense that the child is competent and we believe in that, but we also continue to support or be a resource for them as they need. Any other ideas on that one, the whole trust and security? I hear a lot of families struggle, you know, with adolescents who say, you know, well, you don't trust me. And parents go, you're right, I don't trust you anymore. And kind of having to rebuild that and the forgiveness of breaking trust and rebuilding it. I think from the parental side, I think the dangers here have to do with, you know, expecting perhaps, you know, our children to be different than they might emerge, you know. And I think that's something that we watch very carefully. It's good to watch, you know, because back to affirming their uniqueness, if we can do that, then I think we're saying you're secure with us, even if you turn out to be a Republican, or even if you're, you know, even if you're not to be the Buddhist or whatever, you know, whatever, it may be difficult, but you still have a secure place in our heart.
It is difficult, I think, to have trust.
Yeah.
And it, you know, but yet you know that you can't control where they're at all the time anyway. They're out with their friends running around. I mean, we have a 16-year-old and a 19-year-old. Oh, boy, college. It's in high school, and they both got driver's licenses. So we have to, you know, you almost are forced to have to say, you know what the rules are, so, you know, we hope, we expect you to abide by them. We trust that you will, and you know, you're going to have to use your own judgment and take the consequences for it.
Right, yeah, which is, boy, that's got to be a scary part. I have to confess, my list is 10, so I listen carefully with the teenage stuff. And that's, well, those are big steps. Those are really big steps. When the parenting has communicated, you know, that basically you're communicating that authority, that adults are trustworthy, then you've got this whole, you know, pushing away that happens with adolescents, and by God's will, they're going to have other adults that they come to. And the other thing is that your voice or your rules also gets interjected, put into them. And your voice is in there, whether, you know, the name, so, you know, your rules and your, and so they do think, if not consciously at some level, they're thinking, what would mom or what would dad say? And let me encourage you that does function.
Hopefully, the trust that you've instilled will make them feel that, gee, they're not going to, they may yell at me, but they'll really feel badly if I break.
Yeah.
If I'm out doing whatever I'm not supposed to be doing.
Yes, yeah. And you turn that over, and driving is such a good example, I think, at such a vulnerable age. I mean, 16 is really young. But that's a good example, too, because they're making choices. I mean, what, most of their lives away from us by that point anyway. They're tied into the peers. So they're going on automatic pilot of some sort. You know, you pray that there's a reflectivity there.
And I think one of the things that we try to do, I don't know how successful, is we try to drive with them. I mean, oh, he goes through the mountains, you know, for example. And at that point, you're with them, and you can kind of give him guidance so that when he's 25 and he's out driving through the mountains,
how did he do?
The experience.
I'm curious, how did he do? Did he tighten up when you gave him any? Oh, that's great. That's good. See, there's that security.
Yeah. I have to give a little bit of hope.
Okay.
I talked to when this new movie, Angels in the Outfield. All I've ever seen is the TV parts on it, but you see some of the players flying off. I was kidding my husband, every once in a while I can see his mother coming down and grabbing him by the ear. And I said, I expect someday to look up and your mom's right there, just you're floating off. It's some things linger. And I mean, I can say, oh, well, there's your mother. That's your mother's stocking.
Right.
He's 43, so.
Yeah.
Some of the bigger lessons come through.
It's good work, yeah. And because it's they really do take us in, you know. Because the way I understand that is a child is so dependent on their caretakers for doing life. And so I say, you know, how do we do this? What are the rules? How do we orient ourselves? How do we narrow down the choices? That sort of thing. And you really, by your, you know, again, the actions speak louder than words, but the big stuff comes through. I think, I don't know any research on this, but from therapeutic experience, children, even though they look different than their parents, still have the basic values, the basic foundational stuff is still there. No matter what mortification they go through, it's still there. And we see this in terms of, say, just in terms of church attendance, you see often a drifting, dropping off, and then a coming back when they have their children. That's a very common. That's interesting. That was one of the scenes. Huh?
Somebody's being called on all you see in the sky. I know my mother. My mother-in-law's been gone for 10 years, but there are still things I know my husband does.
Right.
I think a lot of it is done out of respect, and he still wouldn't want to disappoint her.
I see.
And we always had that. Your mother was whispering in here.
Yeah, right.
She's going to go like this one of these days. Yeah. And he always catches himself or whatever.
That's quite a legacy. I mean, that's certainly a part of the way that we live. We live on, no doubt about it. And
she was very much one. Yeah. He had a lot of leeway, but she had few rules. But the rules she had, you didn't.
Right. Wasn't a lot of dialogue.
No, you didn't know. This wasn't the one you got options on the other ones, but not these.
Gotcha. Well, let's see. The other two would be affirmation, encouragement. Are kind of together. I'm putting you in charge, God says in Genesis 1. Liveliness and industry would be the parenting task. Basically, we use the phrase awakening the child's spirit and helping them develop their competencies. That's just basically the whole area of letting kids do things, making a mess, inviting them into adult stuff. I think of Carmen's family and see your little girl running around beating on the drums and grabbing the microphone. But wonderful stuff of being a part and including. Classical thing with sons would be first time they mow the lawn or help dad change the oil or cook bread or wash clothes or whatever. All those first things that go on in families. And that's the business of affirming and encouraging. Yeah, give it a try. I struggle very much. I get this perfectionist side of me, and I've really struggled in this area too, to just let things happen, let them try, and not kind of try to guide it or expect, it's just crazy. There's a part of me that actually expects Aaron or Emily to know things before they've really done it. That's just really weird. I don't know. It's part of the legacy of my own history, so I have to watch that. God certainly gives us enough chances. how does the saying go? This is only a test. If this was, if this was a real thing, we'd have been given more instructions. But some of the skills and mistakes are okay. We can learn from them. Such an important attitude to foster. There are, and it says there's no mistakes. I mean, there are, but we process what's gone wrong and learn from those. You can do it, letting them try, helping them discover the world. That's a very important thing of letting them explore and know different things. And then finally, guidance. The word is a lamp and a guide to me, a light for my path. We educate, we pass on know-how and information. We process as compared to, there's a phrase here, process as compared to symbolic parenting. What that means is, we don't just talk in terms of platitudes and abstracts. We show, again, by our modeling, as well as educate by showing, by active leading. So it isn't like, go out and treat your friends well. It's, you've met somebody, let's talk about, this, or I saw you do this, and boy, you really looked friendly or helpful to that person. That would be a processing way. Then the skills would be modeling, of course, explaining and showing, helping them find their answers and solutions to some degree. And here's again a tricky balance, because we have dreams for our children. I mean, that's inevitable. And how do we let that be there, but then let them find their own place too? God certainly has a vision for us. I think it was revealed in Jesus. But try to find that way of doing it. So dreams can be, And I think that's an important thing to note. Dreams can be, they're inevitable and they're a gift, I think, we give our children. I think it's good to hold them lightly and see how their passion for life unfolds. Because they just, they grow feathers pretty quick, and they, and they try to fly pretty quick, too. Okay, so those are some of the areas there. And I think when we add in divine character and the whole thing of how we're parented, and one of the primary things we're looking at here is how we become as family members, as parents or spouses, conduits or vessels of divine compassion and love in the world, justice, reconciliation, forgiveness. It's a family that often gives us, or certainly our most extensive experiences in that. And then that becomes, of course, the base for our child's passing that on to their own family. And let's just add, whatever we do, whatever adequate here, our child's job is to do better than we've done. I think it's a real important part, you know, is that they're gonna sort out the good and the bad, what they didn't like and what they did like. And their job is really to do better than we do, that's for sure. But of course, that can be a self-esteem struggle for herself, but I like to put that in because I think that's part of the adventure going on spiritually, particularly in our families, in this whole business of modeling and teaching and passing on basic stuff. That's sort of, you know, it's kind of an ambivalent prayer I have. Okay, we're pretty close. Any other comments, questions here? We got a lot with teenagers. Any with preteens? Yeah, that's right. What are your children's ages?
12, 5, and 3.
And 3, yeah, okay.
She's got it all right. 5-year-old is all
it's
time to do with a
12-year-old. 7 years. 7 years is, I consider that generation. With children's age. Yeah, with children's age. Anything over 5 years old, you're going to get this sense, just psychologically, that the person is one is another adult. Yeah. And then that's a real tricky setup. But, well, what are the challenges? So, we're letting go, doing what we can while they're there. It certainly goes fast. That's the other thing here.
I'm looking maybe a little, my daughter's 11 and a half and my son's just turned 14. Uh-huh. And I guess, I don't know, naively or whatever, but my husband and I keep holding out that, well, hopefully our example is still as much of an impact as anything else.
Yes.
Does that seem to hold true? We're going on that hope. If not everything is verbalized, some of it is still by our actions and our examples, and the children will still
absorb.
And because my 14-year-old, there's not a whole lot of what I would call verbal dialogue going on.
Right. Sort of close in to themselves and male, right?
Yeah.
Male, yes. Okay. Right. There's I would call it a stage of privacy that really is quite intense, I think, with adolescents. They just push away from intimacy. They're so, is he pretty social also? Or?
Pretty social.
Yeah. So he's got those friends. And this transition, while they're still anchored at home, you know, they've got this safe base that they know they're going to be fed in, at least physically, and then they venture into this other world, and that's really good. You can articulate that because I think.